Sometimes commonplace phrases and proverbs, not biblical proverbs, but just commonplace phrases and sayings that you hear out in the world as you live can make a good starting point for sermons. And I know that that kind of thing has been used many times before. And I've been thinking about one this week that I've heard most of my life. I probably began hearing it from my own dad, and then have heard it, you know, on the news or many other places throughout my life. And I imagine everybody here has heard it from one time or another. And the phrase is this: there is no free lunch. Has anybody ever heard that? Or there are variations of that. There ain't no free lunch is another one. But, of course, that's a double negative, which means the opposite of what it, but, you know, I'll let Rick, he's the grammar guy, you know, worry about that. But there is no free lunch. It's a common saying. And I guess I always thought, never researched it before, but it is interesting to research common phrases and see what their origins are. And I always assumed that it must have come from the free lunch program, perhaps in public schools, or it came from some political economic ideology is what I always thought. Well, that's actually not the case, apparently. I cross-referenced several sources, and they all said the same thing. And that is that the phrase actually came out of the 20s, the 1920s and 30s, when there were taverns or bars that sold alcohol, beer, and such, but they also would have meals. You know, they would have lunch and supper. Well, their lunches were usually fairly. They didn't have a lot of customers at lunchtime because people were working and didn't have a lot of time to go in and eat. So what they would do is they would have signs out, and this was again in the 20s and 30s, that said free lunch. And the idea was that you go in, if you go in and you can get a free lunch if you buy this, you know, large mug of beer. And so what they would do is they would feed you very salty, dry sorts of meals, you know, crackers and, I don't know, cured ham or peanuts or something like that, where you would want to drink more. You know, whatever you were drinking, you would want more to drink. So in the final analysis, of course, the owner of the tavern would end up recouping his investment of the free meal and then some, you know. So that's the idea, and apparently that's where the phrase came from. And everybody came to recognize, of course, that there ain't no free lunch. You actually paid for it. You just didn't pay for it directly. You paid for it indirectly through the buying of the beer. And as far as I understand, in the economics of restaurants still today, the beverage that you buy, I don't, of course, buy beer, but I do buy tea oftentimes. The markup is much greater on the beverage than it is on the food. So they make a lot of the profit actually on the beverage as opposed to the food. So be that as it may, it's an interesting, you know, it's kind of interesting to go back and look at where things came from. So as I looked into that a little bit farther, eventually the basic idea embodied and it came to mean, it came to express something about an economic idea. And in fact, that economic idea was written in a book by Milton Friedman, who was the economic advisor to Ronald Reagan, President Ronald Reagan. And so it sort of embodied a conservative principle of there is no free lunch. Everything has to be paid for, and the books have to balance. And that's basically, it would be needless, I guess, to say in this audience that it might be helpful for the present administration to go back and read that book. free health care and, you know, free lunch and all kinds of other free things. The idea is that somebody has to pay. No, there isn't anything free, really, at least not in that way. So what I want to do here is make some analogies to this that relate to a consistency of God's character. And we're going to be looking at a physical law that basically says the same thing, there's no free lunch, and then a spiritual idea that says essentially the same thing. So anyway, everybody has heard this before, you can't get something for nothing, and somebody has to pay. Accountants, of course, if the Hansons were here tonight, they would be certainly amening the fact that the books have to balance. At the end of, you know, when at the bottom of the page, it has to, everything has to balance out. And if it's not balanced, then there's some mischief going on somewhere, you know, in the bookkeeping. So just hold on to those thoughts there for a moment while I talk about, while we show this same basic principle in the universe. There is a law in the realm of laws of physics. There's a law called the conservation of energy. And it's an interesting law. And I've studied in times past related to evolution, but I'm not talking about that today. But it has other implications. It does have implications in the origin of the universe and things like that that show very clearly that it couldn't have come from nothing. But that's not really what I'm talking about today. You can't get something for nothing. And so the conservation of energy has never been contradicted. As far as we know, it never is. It's always proven to be correct and right. There's another name for it, or as closely related to it, is the first law of thermodynamics, which says that matter can be neither created nor destroyed, at least not by man or any natural forces. It cannot be either created or destroyed. That's the first law of thermodynamics. So the account books of energy must also balance even the energy that is lost through heat or friction still balances. The numbers always come up to zero in the final analysis. The law is easy to recognize in common everyday activities, and there could be a lot of these, but I thought I'd just think about for a moment driving a car, and many in here would know how an automobile, an internal combustion engine works much better than I do. But if we think about how it works, you've got when you drive your car, the gasoline that you put in the gas tank provides potential energy. There's potential energy in the gas itself. That potential energy is converted into the combustion in an expansion of that energy, which, of course, moves the pistons. The pistons then are connected mechanically, eventually, to the drive shaft and to the wheels. And you put on the gas, you know, and you go down the road. The resulting, along the way, though, there's some of the energy that is converted to heat in the form of heating up the engine, which in turn requires a cooling system. Your car also has a cooling system so that it doesn't overheat. It has friction with the air as it's going down the road, has friction with the tires as it's going down the road. There's some friction in the spinning of the tires as well. All kinds of things like that slow the car down. So there's forces working against the car while you're going down the road. And of course, there's hot gases that are going out the exhaust pipe. And part of the conversion, or all of these are part of the conversion, from one energy form to another, and some of the energy is converted through a generator to an electrical form that provides for the battery to start the engine up, the spark plugs, and necessary electrical needs there. So here's the thing, though. If you were to add up, and this has been done many times in many different kinds of experiments, if you were to add precisely, in a calculated way, add the energy of the fuel, and then exactly subtract all the ways that the energy is being converted, the number would always end up being zero. The exact amount of energy equals the exact amount of energy that is being consumed. So there isn't any energy or matter that is either being lost or gained. It's hard to believe, really, that that is the case, but apparently it is. This has been a well-established physical law. Now, if we go back to the Bible, on the first day of creation, God created the heavens and the earth. He created matter and energy that had not previously existed. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And on the seventh day, of course, he rested from all his creative work that he made. So God was not making more matter or more energy after the sixth day. He had stopped his creative work. And except for special miracles like a bush burning, for example, that was not being consumed, God was providing new energy in such a case as that, because ordinarily a bush would be consumed. So there's other things we look at. In fact, pretty much all miracles fall into this case. It's new energy being supplied into a otherwise closed system. Virgin birth. The virgin birth of Christ is another example. There's something new coming into the whole system. It was not from the seed of man. Another example would be the resurrection of a dead person like Lazarus. Christ added new energy to an otherwise dead body after 4 days, dead, totally dead. He added new energy into the system, an otherwise closed system. So it's interesting how that this works. God can overrule his own laws and provide a free lunch if he wants to, and he has. He did that for the feeding of the 5,000 plus and the feeding of the 4,000 plus. That was actually a free lunch that didn't come from the earth. It was new matter was being introduced into the universe. So those are exceptions to the rule, but they're exceptions that only God himself can make. Nobody else can make those exceptions other than God. God can intervene in his own creation if he wants to. So these times, though, of miracles are rare, of course, throughout the Bible. But in all of that, the point is that neither matter nor energy cannot come from nowhere, and it cannot go anywhere. It cannot disappear into nowhere. It's either here or it isn't. It can change form, which we see it happening all the time, every single day. It's changing form, but there's no new energy being added. So energy is neither gained nor lost in the end, but only changes from one form to another. That's the second law of thermodynamics. Incidentally, probably many of you know this, but there are no patents issued for perpetual motion machines because of this phenomenon. You can't get a patent for a perpetual motion machine. But there was a time in which people were trying to get patents for a perpetual motion machine, but they said, it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work, so there's no point in patenting it, because a perpetual motion machine would mean that there's new energy coming from somewhere. It's not using energy in the same way that the rest of the universe works. So now I want to kind of, since we've got that out, I want to kind of extrapolate or draw out a spiritual truth from this physical law and the conservation of energy. It reveals something to us, I believe, about God, about who he is, about his character, and about how he operates. And it's really interesting when you can discern something about our Creator that is embodied in his universe. And this is one of those things, I believe, I'm convinced that this is part of his nature. And that is that God's books must always balance. Always. There aren't any exceptions to it. In the physical realm, that's obviously true. Another way to say it is, God is just. He is just. If you think about the old-fashioned style of weight, a justice scales, where you have the scales and a balance in the middle, and then there's two little, plates that hang off on the sides on little chains. And the idea is that, in fact, if you go into a lot of courtrooms, in fact, I believe this sculpture, if I remember correctly, is on the top of the courthouse in Hendersonville. But it's a fairly well-known sculpture that someone has sculpted over the years as an allegory of what justice means. And it's a woman who's holding in one hand the scales of justice, and they're balanced on this sculpture. And she has a blindfold around her eyes, and in the other hand, she has a sword. Maybe you've seen that sculpture. I have a number of times. Well, it's an allegorical figure, like the Statue of Liberty is an allegorical figure. It's a person that represents something that is intangible, liberty, freedom. Well, in this case, why would the woman be holding the scales? Well, the scales represent a balanced, just case. In other words, the intent of this court is to judge fairly and rightly, righteously. Why does she have the blindfold on? Well, because she is blind to partiality. It doesn't matter whether the person coming in to get justice from the court is rich or poor, or black or white, or bond or free. It doesn't matter. Whoever comes into this court, we're blind. This is the idea is we're blind to being partial about how we're going to judge this case. We're going to judge it on its merits, not on the fact that this person is poor or rich. And then, of course, the sword is the other part of judgment, justice, and that is that there is a proper punishment for those who are deemed to be guilty of some crime. So all three of those things sort of work together, justice, impartiality, and punishment. So now I want to look at kind of an example, a practical example of the scriptures here. And the eighth commandment says that thou shalt not steal. That's in Exodus 20 and verse 15. So you shall not take something that someone else worked to acquire. That would be unjust. That would be the balance would be tipped one way or, it would be tipped. It wouldn't be right. It wouldn't be level. Paul said, if anyone would not work, neither should he eat. That's in 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Now, what if a person is going into one of our Ingles grocery stores, and you go by the deli, and just sort of take one of those, you know, pre-made sandwiches that are wrapped up in plastic, and is, if it's a woman with a big purse, maybe, and just sticks it in there, and maybe she gets a bag of potato chips and sticks it in there, and a drink, and sticks it in there, and she goes out of Ingles. Now, did she get a free lunch? Well, she may have gotten a free lunch, but somebody has to pay for that free lunch that she got, and unjustly. Mr. Ingle has to pay for that lunch that this person stole. But there's more than Mr. Ingle that has been wronged and violated, and that is God. Because God says, thou shalt not steal. So if you steal something, the accounting books, when you know that Ingles store tabulates all of the things coming in and going out, and they look there and say, well, looks like something's amiss here. Something's missing. These items here are not accounted for. So not only is this person in trouble with Mr. Ingle, but he's also in trouble with God, because God is the one who ultimately balances the books. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 14 says that, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Matthew 12:36 says that every idle word that men speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. This is an attribute of God. His right balance is an attribute of God that is undeniable. All the other attributes of God work within this sense of justice that God has. God's love, for example, works within his justice. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But God, his books must balance. He cannot simply overlook injustice. God must judge sin because sin is breaking the law. In short, every sin must be paid for in order for God's books to balance. In the universe, as we've seen, there is no way to break the law of conservation of energy. You cannot break it if you wanted to. You cannot break it. It is as certain as the law of gravity. In the physical realm, God's laws are inescapable. Romans 6:23 says that the wages of sin is death. The law of sin and death is as equally inescapable as the law of gravity or the law of the conservation of energy. They are all God's laws, and they cannot be broken. So in both science and salvation, the answer lies outside, as far as the balancing of the books, the answer lies outside of the physical universe, and certainly outside of the sinner, the one who has stolen the lunch, the one who has disobeyed God's laws. The balancing of the books lies outside of the physical universe in order to have balance. God does not live inside of the physical universe or its laws in the same way that you and I do. He is outside them. He created them. He was before them. So he is everlasting. He is eternal. He's not affected by the things that we are affected by. He exists before creation from eternity. So he has the right to intervene inside the universe from the outside of the universe. So it is with God's balance, the accounts of sin and injustice. God intervenes from the outside to save us. And there is a consistency here to God's balance in both the physical and spiritual applications. God's love operates within his justice. The only way that God could let a sinner deserving of death within the law of sin and death into his heavenly home in a way in which is just and right is for the sin to be paid for. It has to be paid for. Somebody has to pay for it. In John, 4 and verse 10, it says, "Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation," that is, the payment for sin, for our sins. So the first part of that verse tells us that God loved us even when we didn't love him. And the second part shows that God's love comes without denying God's justice. His love and his justice work together perfectly. And he provided a sacrifice, and thereby balancing the books of God's righteousness and his righteous judgment on mankind. Jesus, of course, by himself, bore the price of the sins of the entire world, past, present, and future. So God's love operates within his justice. So both God's perfect love and God's perfect justice is seen in the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. God is both the just and the justifier, as Romans 3:26 says, of him who believes in Jesus. He is the just and the justifier of them which believe in Jesus. We started off our thoughts with this phrase, there's no free lunch. And in the ultimate sense, as we've noted, and this phrase is true. But if someone voluntarily spends his hard-earned money to buy your lunch, let's say, is it then free to you? Well, yes, it is. You can get a free lunch if someone else voluntarily pays for it. And many people have done that for me. I've occasionally done that for other people. What if someone bought you a gift card for a really, really nice place to eat? Say, I think the one out at the Grove Park Inn is maybe the Sunset Terrace. Great place to eat. I've never been there, but I understand it's a great place to eat. So it's, or maybe the, you know, one of the restaurants on the Biltmore Estate or something really, really special. Something really, really. What if someone bought you a gift card and went ahead and paid for it already and then gave it to you, a friend, and says, I want you to have this. I want you to enjoy this. You go out there and have this really great meal. Well, let's say you stuck the gift card in your wallet and you kind of forgot about it. And until some months later, when your friend that gave you the card just, you know, says, well, how did you enjoy the lunch out there at the Sunset Terrace? And you maybe you haven't used it yet, so you have to say, well, I hadn't been out there yet. I've just been eating my rice and beans, and you know, sometimes I'll eat my beans and rice just for variety. So I haven't used it yet. Well, your friend might say, well, now you did notice on the card that there was an expiration date. I mean, you have to use the card within a year, or otherwise it simply expires. And so you'd say, well, oh, definitely, I don't worry. I mean, I'm going to use the card within a year. Well, what if you stick it back into your wallet And the whole year goes by, and you just never take advantage of the card that this friend gave you. And after the thing expires, it had already been paid for, and the person who paid for it can't get his money back. It's gone. But you still have this card, but you can't use it anymore. It's expired. Now, what if your friend then, you run into him again after the card has expired, and he asks you, well, I know that you must have enjoyed the meal out there at the temple at the Sunset Terrace, and you'd have to, hang your head in shame and say, well, actually, I neglected it. I had other things to do. I never did make it out there. I never took advantage of the generosity that you showed me. That would be sad, wouldn't it? That would be sad. And it would be, how would the person that gave you this card, wanting you to take advantage of this great experience, but you never did, how would he feel about you just totally neglecting it and not taking time to take advantage of his generosity? Well, he'd feel pretty sad about that, I would think. But obviously, this story has a parallel. Jesus has prepaid for something infinitely grander than a meal here on earth, no matter how fancy. He's prepaid for something that is infinitely grander and greater, and that is eternity with him in heaven. And he's paid for it whether or not we use it. He has already paid for it. And it does have an expiration date. And that expiration date is when we expire. That is the expiration date. There is no more. And he would be pretty sad if we didn't take advantage of his generosity in prepaying for something with his own blood that we could not have paid for ourselves. So it's a free gift. That's the way it's spoken of in the Bible. It is free to us. We can take advantage of it because Jesus paid for it. So it's free to us if we take advantage of it. He's already paid for it, for you and for I. But you do have to show up. There are things that there, just like the person who had the gift card, he did actually have to go to the restaurant and show up and present the gift card. There are conditions to receiving the free gift, but you do have to show up. And in the case of the Lord, that showing up requires changing your life. It requires repenting of the sins, the injustice that you have, the laws that you have broken against God. But so, because the books are imbalanced, until you receive the free gift from that is paid for by Christ, the books on your account as an individual remain unbalanced. They're tilted one way. They're not level. They're tilted. And only God can make them level. And he offers that free gift through the paid-for sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That's the way it works. Can we help you today? Is there anyone here who would like to come to the Lord today and have your sins washed away, have it forgiven, have your sins forgiven, and once again, there will be a balance. Your account in the book of God will be level. It will be balanced. The weights will be just again because God has paid the price. Jesus has paid the price. If there's anybody that is subject to the gospel tonight, would you come while together we stand and sing?